Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. You will notice a slightly different configuration on the bench today, and that's for two reasons. Justice Brister ended his 5 years of service on the court as of yesterday. We had a nice dinner reception for him last night. And in the first case, Justice Willett is not sitting. There are three matters on the court's oral submission docket in the order of their appearance. They are docket number 071050, Zachary Construction Corporation versus Texas A&M University from Brazos County and the 10th Court of Appeals District. Justice Willett not sitting in that matter. Docket number 061018, D.R. Horton, Texas Limited versus Markel International Insurance Company from Harris County and the 14th Court of Appeals District. And 070960, In the Interest of BGCW and Other Children from Angelina County and the 12th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument, and we will take a brief recess after the first one. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 071050, Zachary Construction and Others versus Texas A&M University.
Please the court, Mr. Taylor will present argument for the petitioners. The petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, and may I please the court and esteemed opposing counsel. We're before the court on a case that was a denial of plea to the jurisdiction as to the Zachary defendants. And
Mr. Taylor, is there anything left? I mean, as best I can calculate it, we've got some claim of contractual indemnity and complaint about the Court of Appeals opinion. Is there anything left other than those two?
The responsible third party is the issue that's the most important, and that is definitely left. We have a Court of Appeals opinion and a November 14, 2007 modified judgment that holds sovereign immunity bars all the claims the defendants are asserting.
But why didn't the settlement turn the state into a settling party as opposed to a responsible third party?
Settling person is the statutory language, and there is a good argument that the Texas A&M University is now and forever will be a settling person.
Does anybody disagree that they're a settling party?
The Texas A&M University has now judicially admitted that it is a settling person, and the Zachary defendants agree that Texas A&M University is a settling person. Your Honor, we don't have a point of error or an issue or point presented before the court on that. On November 3rd, we asked for leave to add that within days after the settlement, and Texas A&M University's response was, well, that's opposed, subject to further review. And after the denial of our petition for review and then the grant of our rehearing, apparently it was reviewed a little more carefully.
And so the question is, if they will be submitted, whether as a settling party, obviously as a settling party now, what opinion would you have us write?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the court does have the power on affidavit or otherwise, as the court may determine appropriate under Article 5, Section 3, we haven't cited this, to ascertain such matters of fact as are necessary in the proper exercise of the jurisdiction. Texas A&M University has it on their website that they're a settling person. The Solicitor General judicially admits it. Apart from some of the adversarial statements in the motion that A&M filed on August 27th, they're probably right that if this court vacates the modified judgment of the Waco Court of Appeals, that's absolutely essential. We've been tagged for 50% of nearly $8,000 or $9,000 of costs. But more importantly, Steve Smith is a judge who follows appellate decisions, and right now he has a published opinion and a November 14, 2007 modified final judgment, and that has to be vacated if and only if this court follows that procedure, and if this court rules as a matter of law that Texas A&M University is now and forever will be a settling person. then in that event, we would respectfully disagree that the cause is moot. The judgment of the Court of Appeals could be vacated, and the cause would be dismissed under that rationale, and that is the relief that we finally learned was requested.
There'd be nothing to prevent the trial court from making that determination. The trial court hasn't had a chance to rule on that.
Let me disagree respectfully on that, Your Honor. If on page 803, the Attorney General has amply demonstrated in the briefs and supported in oral argument that because there is no statute or resolution of the legislature authorizing them, the doctrine of sovereign immunity bars all of the appellees, that's us, claims, whether for contribution, indemnity, a determination of proportionate responsibility, or based in contract. Our brief on the merits filed in June 2008 has the Zachary defendant's answer in front of you, and we plead that Texas A&M University should be submitted either as a defendant, a responsible third party, or a settling person. That claim was pleaded and was before the Waco court. It's true there was not briefing in the Waco court about settling person because Texas A&M University did not disclose its settlement to the public until October 28, 2008. But
it sounds like all the parties are going to go before the judge and say and agree that Texas A&M is a settling person and is going to be submitted under Chapter 33.
I'd have to go outside the record on that, Your Honor. There are a number of plaintiffs. The Attorney General did not, the Solicitor General did not copy the plaintiffs on the motion to dismiss as mootness. We did copy the plaintiffs on our motion. There has been no response from the plaintiffs. I assume they're listening to this argument right now. We have no judicial admission that Texas A&M University is a settling person. The trial court right now is bound by the Waco court decision. Neither the opinion of the Solicitor General nor the opinion of the Zachary defendants binds the trial court.
Well, you say they're bound by the Court of Appeals opinion. They're bound to the determination of responsible third party as to that ruling, but there's been no ruling as to settling person. So I'm troubled. I'm confused about what the trial court would be bound by in terms of submitting the state as a settling person.
Right. And when we responded to the mootness motion, we set forth the objection we anticipate plaintiffs may make. I think outside the record, I think there's a division among the plaintiffs whether they're going to agree that the settling person elements are met. The elements actually overlap. Is or may be liable. The settlement that Texas A&M University paid had to be in consideration of potential liability to meet the settling person definition. Well, we have a lot of briefing before this court, before the Waco court. They're not a person. They're not subject to any sort of liability. The Solicitor General says the opinion of the Court of Appeals is clearly correct. All of the claims are barred. It is true that there was not briefing before the Waco court about the settling person. There is currently no point of error or issue of point presented about settling person. At the same time, though, the modified judgment of the Waco Court of Appeals is consistent with this opinion saying that all claims are barred. So while we believe Judge Smith would probably overrule an objection, I mean, he was going to submit them as a responsible third party. He actually looked at the statute, unlike the Waco court, and was going to submit them as a responsible third party, we would still face that objection. It destroys the mootness unless this court makes an authoritative pronouncement that they are a settling person, is our respectful submission. I just want to briefly cover a couple of procedural points because it's obvious the court is now engaged on the mootness issue. But on the merits, our first couple of issues involve Rule 47 and the passage I just read to you. I've never before, I don't know what to tell a client when I write a brief and I learn that the other side's brief and their oral argument have amply persuaded the court that they're right. And I think about, as an appellate practitioner, suppose my hat is off to the Solicitor General's office. How do you persuade a court of appeals that your opponent's arguments are so meritless they don't even deserve to be mentioned? If the Waco Court of Appeals had written instead, the Zachary defendants have amply demonstrated in their briefs and their oral arguments that sovereign immunity doesn't apply. We affirm. Well, the university would be before you, and they would be right. I mean, we might be right in the on the merits, but there's no opinion by the Court of Appeals. I want to cite Justice Johnson's opinion for the court recently in In re Columbia Health Center. This is newer than the briefs, and I know the court divided 5-4 on the propriety of reviewing new trial orders on mandamus. That's a hard issue that divides people in good faith. But what the court, I believe, Justice O'Neill, there was no dissent from the point that the courts of appeals and the Supreme Court under Rules 47 and 63 have a duty to explain by written opinion their analyses and conclusions as the issues necessary to a final determination of the appeal. We had in the trial court, both in the reporter's record and in the clerk's record, we have Texas A&M University has no standing to complain about being joined as a response. They don't have any standing. There's no such thing as a money judgment against a responsible third party. Now the terminology is designate. Before, the terminology was joinder. But if you read the definitions in the statute, there's a defendant, there's a liable defendant, responsible third party is not in there. It's not until, like in the case Judge Medina wrote, until the plaintiff takes that extra step and serves an amended petition, serves the citation, then that person becomes a defendant. But just the joinder before 2003 or the designation after 2003 doesn't make you a defendant. There's only one case. There's a 14th Court of Appeals unpublished mandamus case that just held without discussing the statute. You have to serve a citation, and that's not correct. There's a newer published 14th Court of Appeals case that holds correctly that under 33004, the responsible third parties are not actually parties. We've got before you in our reply brief, and I know the court may struggle with whether...
The case you just cited from the Court of Appeals. 14th
Court of Appeals, 2006, is J period M period K period. It was in a weird limitations context, but they're actually published, and they cite 33.004 deals only with non-parties, and that was a case coming up under the 1995 version of the Act. So the only authority that goes against us is an unpublished 14th Court of Appeals mandamus case that only has a Westlaw site. This court didn't even get to look at it on a further mandamus. And I would respectfully urge the court to consider also, behind our reply brief is an opinion by Sam Kent, and I with all of his issues, he is someone who has looked at a lot of bonfire litigation. The Solicitor General persuaded him to make a number of erroneous rulings he got reversed on. But we actually did bring to the Waco court, we followed their rules, we appended Greg Lensing's thoughtful law review article that actually had this order, and we talked to them about it. The idea of being a responsible third party is you're not a party against whom any relief can be granted. And that was so held by Sam Kent. Well, we couldn't get them to address that. We've appended that behind our September 22 reply brief, and Judge Kent has a couple of citation errors. I mean, some of the subdivisions are a little tricky, but it is a well thought out opinion, and you might not even agree with it. We think it actually is right, but either way, it shows what happened to our case and what is going to happen to the jurisprudence if appeals courts that may be having problems can just decide important issues like this. And the reason you know it's important is that the Solicitor General himself has parachuted into this case and realized, oh my goodness, we have to have this opinion stand. It's a hugely important opinion. Of course, it's in their favor, and if it stands, then I guess we just go let the Solicitor General's briefs and oral arguments tell us what the law is. We continue respectfully to request that the judgment of the Court of Appeals be reversed and the orders permitting joinder merely for responsible third-party purposes be affirmed by this court, and alternatively, that this court dismiss Texas A&M University's purported appeal from that order because Texas A&M University has no standing to complain about that order. And unless there are questions, I'll give back some of the court's time.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Taylor. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Ho will present argument for the respondent.
Mr. Ho, what's your response to Mr. Taylor's last comment that we should dismiss this because Texas A&M has no standing here to complain?
The standing argument appears to be essentially a restatement of their merits argument. Their theory of the statute is that we have no liability, no vulnerability to liability under the 1995 law. We submit that that would be great. The university would be happy if that were true. It just does not appear to be the best reading of that statute. That debate is obviously a merits issue, not a standing issue.
So what's left?
Nothing is left, Your Honor. Based on petitioner's responses this morning, it does appear that they now agree that this case is moot. After all, nobody really disputes that the university is indeed a settling person, and that moots this case. If this court were to hold that A&M is a settling person, and that that fact essentially moots these claims, there's no reason to think that the lower courts would not obey that decision.
But how could we make that holding? I mean, isn't that an evidentiary determination to some point? We don't have a formal stipulation here. Why not just let the trial court make that finding? I don't see that we have enough evidence before us to make a finding of a settlement.
The settlement itself is before this court. If this court decides that the case is moot, the reason for that mootness finding would be because the university is in fact a settling person, a fact that this issue that is not disputed in this court. So it would be an essential the finding of settling person would be essential to this court's jurisdictional analysis with
when
respect
you
to mootness.
The settlement is before this court. What do you mean?
The settlement papers have been filed with this court. It was entered as a judgment, and it has been filed with this court. So there's no dispute. There's no fact dispute, certainly, that the university has settled. There's no legal dispute that the university is, in fact, a settling person.
But when all parties before this court say the cause is moot, we've settled our differences, do we typically write opinions saying why we dismiss the case is moot? Because there's a settlement between the parties? I mean, why do we have to go behind the fact that it appears to me that everyone agrees that the case is moot?
You would not have to. It would be the court's option. If you look at the Houston Cable case, the Ritchie versus, aside in our case, Ritchie versus Vasquez, the court can issue a very short per curiam opinion if it wants to. And essentially, if, as I noted, if the court decides that this is in fact the case, that the university is a settling person, no reason to think the lower courts will not obey, and in fact, of course, they would be required to obey, both under the doctrine of stare decisis and the law of the case doctrine.
But my question, maybe it's similar to Justice O'Neill's, do we even have to decide that question, or can we just dismiss the case?
It would be the court's option.
Okay.
The court could just simply go directly to the mootness holding. I will just briefly, if the court would like, would briefly describe what the court might want to consider doing in light of this mootness that we face today, what the court should do with the three claims that are in this case. First, the responsible third-party claim is now moot. The only reason the petitioners say they sought to bring in the university, to join the university as a responsible third party, was simply to place the university on the jury verdict form. Petitioners obviously suffer no harm, and they allege no harm, by having the verdict form correctly list the university as a settling person rather than incorrectly, and we would submit unlawfully, list the university as a responsible third party. Second, the contribution claim. That claim is now moot, because under Chapter 33, defendants cannot obtain contribution from a settling person. And the Scott McCon petitioners have already conceded this point. And this is available in the statute at Section 33.015, subsection D. Because those two claims are now moot, the court should dismiss those claims, vacate the judgments below accordingly, while leaving the opinion intact, pursuant to the court's usual procedure, as described in Ritchie and Houston Cable. Finally, with respect to the third claim, the indemnity claim, the court should simply affirm the judgment below. As this court has repeatedly stated, breach of contract suits are barred by sovereign immunity. So there's essentially no need to address the merits of the case. I'm happy to answer any questions if there are any issues, and happy to talk about the merits. But if there are no questions on the merits, we would be content to rest on our briefing on both the merits and the mootness issues.
Any questions?
One question. It was suggested by Mr. Taylor that there might be some plaintiffs below that might contest the question of settling party. Is that a possibility or not?
We would not presume to speculate what plaintiff's counsel might say in the court below. We don't see how it could be disputed under the text of the statute, how we're not a settling person, and of course if this court were to go ahead and hold that, then there would be really no opportunity for the plaintiffs to dispute, but we obviously we don't know for sure one way or the other.
You say it doesn't matter.
It shouldn't matter. There's really no argument under the statute. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Ho. The court will hear rebuttal.
Only a few points of clarification. The statement was made, the settlement is before the court. What is before the court at our doing is the October 28, 2008 final judgment. I would have to go outside the record, but I will say, having read that settlement agreement, and we can present it to the court if the court wants to see it, a requirement of that agreement was that new petitions be filed, again naming Texas A&M University directly as a defendant. And on information and belief, I believe that was done, and then Judge Smith signed the judgment that Texas A&M University requested. That judgment also, interestingly, had a severance in it. Didn't say set up a new cause number. It just said all claims against Texas A&M University are severed. That was something Texas A&M University requested originally and didn't get, and we've raised that as a potential jurisdictional problem. In the end, I agree with the Solicitor General, that's probably not a jurisdictional problem. Chief Justice Jefferson, if there was any suggestion that an opinion might not be necessary, I must vociferously and strenuously disagree with that. Judge Green raised the possibility, and it is a possibility. There are a lot of plaintiffs and a lot of plaintiffs' lawyers, and obviously they have to make their call on what positions they're going to assert. But a lot of the briefing that was presented below would support technical arguments that we would have to litigate before Judge Smith. Again, I believe Judge Smith would correctly overrule those objections. But without, as Mr. Ho admits, an authoritative pronouncement by this court, the mootness theory doesn't work. It has to be.
But why wouldn't that be advisory? I mean, they haven't been raised below because they haven't been ripe to raise. And if they haven't been brought up to the Court of Appeals, then wouldn't it be purely advisory on our part?
I've given that a lot of thought. I mean, we did move on November 3, 2008 for leave to amend our petitions for review to add point 13, whether the settlement agreement. We did it, and it was opposed, and this court originally denied our petition. The court could revisit that ruling and grant leave to amend to add that point of error, and if it decides on the mootness issue, I think the court probably should. Article 5, Section...
Why should we decide it in a case where the parties agree? If there is an issue about the language in consideration of potential liability, then why would we want to decide that issue where both sides agree?
And this gets to a very sensitive part of the argument, and that is, with respect, our case is now pending before the court. The granting of an application for writ of error admits the case in the court which shall proceed with the case as provided by law. And right now we have points before the court. A petition for review is an application for writ of error for government code purposes. The court, in our respectful view, must decide the merits if the merits are still...
We can dismiss it as improvidently granted as well.
Right, and it's true that this court has the power to do something that's not right, but that would not be right in our respectful submission. The appropriate judgment of this court, as Rule 47 and Rule 63 require, is to explain by written opinion the court's analyses and conclusions. If the court decides the case is moot, we have a judgment that will be argued against us. We have an opinion that will be argued against us. We have very skillful counsel urging how important it is that opinion stay intact. So we're before the court asking the court to do what should have been done. They're before the court asking the court once again to deny our side equal protection and appellate due process.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Taylor. The cause is submitted and the court will take a brief